If Murray has supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
The Blubbity Blah.
Sending out good vibes.
Good vibes.
Underneath breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Grime America Show. Coming at you, bonus episode, extra episode, as promised. We mentioned that now that we're both doing this as a full-time gig, this is all we can do. We're canceled, from real life. So we got to just rely on podcasting and everything else because of the shit we said on this show. So, but anyway, we're coming out with more content. We're doing more interviews. We're doing a lot more streaming during the day. Sorry if you were one of the people that was catching us live at night. We are doing a little less of that these days. We're knocking out the show during the day for the most part.
We do try it at least anyways for a bit. You know.
Yeah. As long as it kind of depends where the interviews line up. Honestly, it depends. Some guests are going to have to be evening. Some guests will have to be daytime. But watch that. Alarms if you are one of those people that watch on YouTube. Even if you aren't one of those people that watch on YouTube, I mean, you should be subscribed to the YouTube channel anyway, because if you're the kind of person that likes your show, it'll help put the show in front of other people that might like the show. And we do some other stuff that's only on YouTube. I mean, not a lot, but we have started putting some stuff, some more scripted content on the YouTube channel, some light video editing. We got one episode up. I guess most of the stuff we do is on the A-list.
Yeah, AEH-list. So which is the scripted one that you put up on the other YouTube, and the core dismantling video?
Yeah, that's right. It wouldn't have made sense on the A-list.
Yeah. Yeah, if you want a black pill look at the future of humanity, watch that.
Is it a black pill?
It's good. Well, it's pretty it's pretty fear-mongering in a way. I mean, it's good though. I like it.
Yeah, it's just the way.
It fits with, a lot of the work we've done with Randall Carlson and Ethical Skeptic and Douglas Vogt from Die Hold, R.A.P. Doug,
Yeah, it just fits in almost with too much of it.
Yeah.
It really does. I mean, honestly, that some of the new stuff that's coming out makes it pretty hard to... I mean, now I'm into it and looking into it, some people are freaking out saying it's going to happen right away.
Right.
I'm not doing that.
No,
I'm just saying this might be the thing that happens.
Yeah.
That fucks shit up every once in a while. I mean, it could explain it all, right? Why there's like seashells on top of mountains. Maybe they just got washed up there, and maybe the ocean was never on top of those mountains. It just that the water was for
right. For a certain time. Yeah.
And all the other conditions along with it that help make fossils, right? So it's not just like the ocean came up and it had to make some fossils there and now it's a mountain range. The shit got washed in with a bunch of sediment and everything else and a giant
drift. I mean, this is what Ignatius Donnelly's calling it.
Overwash, yeah.
He calls it a drift, right? I mean, this is what the whole book, the Ragnarok, The Age of Fire and Gravel, which I'm reading almost every morning at 9 o'clock live just for an experiment. And it's talking about that. There's a drift of all these boulders and stuff, and it doesn't have fossils in it. And it's different types of gravel and dirt and sand and mud, and it's all dried up, right? But it's just like it was thrown there. It didn't settle there over time. It was just chucked there. And why that book and his work isn't more important and popular right now, it's beyond me. He's talking about all the stuff that you're talking about. The evidence that you're talking about, he's talking about in 1883.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder what they would say nowadays.
I know. Because I can tell some of it's a bit off the science, but I'm sure some of the science is pretty well set too from back then.
Absolutely. Speaking of pretty well set, we'd be pretty well set if we had a few more people coming around to support the show. It really would help. We're trying to push around. We'd like to get We've really only got a few hundred people that support the show. We've got tens of thousands of people that listening. You know, we tried to drive a long time ago to get to 1,000 supporters, and we never quite made it. But I mean, maybe we could get there now. We're giving you guys some extra shows. You know, if 10% of you supported the show, that would be multiple thousands of donations, and it could all just be a dollar, and we would be cool. This is great. But instead, you know, we do have to thank the people that do. It is about 1% or less of people that support the show. So we thank you. We love you. We appreciate you. And when you do, we read your notes. So speaking of which, we did have someone. So that is, of course, grimeamerica.ca/support. So we do all this for free. We've done seven. This is episode 701 over a decade. They're all there. You can just go in. And if your podcast player like only shows 100 or only shows 200 or only shows 300, there's something wrong with your podcast player, because there should be 701 episodes there, all the way back to episode one, Efrain Palermo, who turned out to be right about the stains on Mars. I mean, and then some bangers in the back catalog, Dennis McKenna, Stanley Krippner, who we just talked about him the other day. The oil guy, cannabis oil guy,
Rick Simpson.
And I mean, someone was just asking me the other day if we should talk to Ben Davidson. I was like, we did twice.
I know. And he bailed. You know what? I tried to book him. I had him booked. We showed up and he did a no show. He ghosted us the third time. I don't know if I think it was an honest mistake. I don't think he was avoiding us, but.
And then someone else, you know, who was Ian. Shout out to Ian. Sorry. He mentioned, he's like, man, you got to look into this growing earth. I was like, 164, buddy, Neil Adams.
You know the number and everything. Well, I mean, and the good point of this all is that we keep it ad free, right? We don't have ads except for our own stuff that we talk about, our own initiatives, our own sort of, you know, whatever programs and stuff that we're like our other works we talk about as kind of like an ad. But I mean, we don't have real ads.
You know, they put them in like every 6 minutes. They ask us all the time. We get asked constantly to put in ads. I mean, there's like, they'll put ads in the whole back catalog right now. We just press the button and turn it on. And you're going to make this much. And honestly, it seems like it's more than we make sometimes. But we think that this is a better way to do it. We don't want to do all that. That sucks. And then the advertiser's like, you can't talk about that. And we're like, what? We're not doing that. Fuck you.
Plus, I hate listening to ads and other
things. It's crazy. So do I. So I don't want to make you guys do that. So just support us. If you like it, grimeamerica.ca/support. I do want to say, we just came out on Audible today.
We as... what's his name again?
Zamyatin.
Yeah, that's a good book. Interesting.
Yeah.
If you want a dystopian sci-fi book, we talk a bit about sci-fi with Sarah and David in here. Darren and Sarah, both Dune fans. And we as like, I think Orwell and Huxley got some ideas from We way back. I mean, it's really interesting. Talking about just a society within a society that doesn't even know what's outside, and everything's regulated and everything's measured and everything is like basically perfect in some ways, but not very human. Kind of scary.
So we do have someone supporting us for this show. It was shout out to Joel Van Dyck, who came in with $50. So thank you, Joel. We appreciate it.
That's huge. That. Thanks, Joel.
You're noble. You're a very noble fellow. Of course, that's what we call our donators here, is you become a noble instead of a shitty pleb. And then you're noble. And if you do $1,000, you're a lord. And 10,000 gets you God. But no one's
or got lady.
Or lady. So keep up the great work, gentlemen. I get a good look at the Great White North driving over the Skyway in Buffalo most days. I think of Grimerica often at those times. Enjoy my treasure. Best, Joel.
Thanks, Joel.
In the morning, sir.
Soon you might be not looking at the Great White North.
Might be looking at the greatest state in the union. Anyway, we love our American listeners. We love each and every one of you. We are not caught up in this anti-bull crap. We love you. And, you know, we wouldn't be here without you. So you've done more for us than Canada most days. And
if you don't hear from us for a while, Team Canada might have come and got us.
Yeah, Team Canada is not happy.
There might be there might be a point where we get stuck between the USA and Team Canada.
We're race traitors up there. Anyway, I think we'll leave it at that. Keep it short and sweet. Check out addlebrain.ca. Like we said, we just had a few new audiobooks come out. We're up to 135 on Audible, I think 145 on Spotify, and 150 if you get them directly from us on addlebrain.ca. Contact at thecabin.com, trips and events. We got, like we said, we're looking into Easter Island. We're hoping to announce that in the next month or two for Easter Island for next year. But we do have Bonneville coming up in 6 weeks with Randall Carlson and the gang. And Search for Atlantis with Randall Carlson. There's one spot left. I double checked. So as of right now, there's one ticket left to go Search for Atlantis in the Azores with Randall Carlson and friends, including Graham and I, November this year, 2 weeks, all inclusive. So check that out. Contact at cabin.com. For America Outlawed, the other podcast, alist.ca. If you want to see us, why we're kicked off of Team Canada, that's where we put all our Canada-centric content. And Canadian political stuff and all that. And GrandAmericaCBD.com for all that other good stuff. Other than that, do you have a bio?
Yeah. So Sarah Finn Huntley is a visionary artist, writer, and researcher whose work explores the intersection of psychedelics, technology, and philosophy. She lives in Oregon. She's got a website here. It's sarahfinn.com. SARAPHINN.com. I think that might be under construction. And there's she's also got Instagram.com/dreamseed_VR. And Sarah, what's the other one? She's on X as well. You'll get a, let me just, what is her X? Goblin. Should I find her X account? Now that I've said it. Let me find it now that I've said it, because I need to. It is. It is Seraphim. Goblin Queen. Goblin Queen at Seraphim. Yeah. And David J. Brown. Master's degree. You have some music coming on. Did you know that?
Yeah, I found the background music button.
It's a little too porno-y right now. Just let me finish off the thing. David J. Brown holds a master's degree in psychobiology from New York University, a former neuroscience researcher at the University of Southern California. He's written for Wired, Discover, and Scientific American, and his news stories have appeared in the Huffington Post and CBS News. A frequent guest editor of the MAPS Bulletin, he's the author of more than a dozen books, including The New Science of Psychedelics and Frontiers of Psychedelic Consciousness. So, his links are all there, davidjbrown.com. And this book was, I got a link to the Inner Traditions there. It's .com/ The Illustrated Field Guide to DMT Entities. Yeah, I think that's it.
That porno song is called Feeding the Duck.
Nice.
That one's Night Driving. Lo-fi.
Is this like StreamYard like auto music?
Oh, yeah, they can't fix the buttons or they can't make the audio work properly, but they got daydreaming music. At least it costs a fortune. Anyway, guys, enjoy the chat. David and Sarah.
We've got David J. Brown here with us and Sarah Finn Huntley. Interesting book. We're going to be talking about The Illustrated Field Guide to DMT Entities. So thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, this will be fun. we've been talking about this, you know, over a decade or so, probably. But I don't think I've ever heard of anybody compiling all this into a book. So excited to hear about what you guys have, what your research has found. I mean, I haven't partaked in anything for quite a few years now. So, you know, I haven't really had any entity experiences. Darren's had some DMT experiences, but yeah, we're looking forward to talking to you guys.
Well, yeah, it's a book that was in the ether for a long time. Somebody felt.
what made you guys put it all into a book?
Yeah. Well, it started, I guess, it was an idea that started, I guess, around 12 years ago, 12 to 15 years ago. Sarah and I were tripping one day together in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And we were talking about how interesting it was that there have been so many, you know, common reports from people who have had entity contact experiences. And wouldn't it be interesting to put them together into a book? And I had, you know, as a child, I had collected the Golden Guide, Fields, the Golden Guide to Reptiles and Amphibians, the Golden Guide to Non-Flowering Plants and Insects and Birds. And I used to love walking out in the wild with my dad and trying to identify different species in the wild. And we thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to put together a field guide with the different DMT entities that people report, since they were so commonly reported. And Sarah's a brilliant artist, and I'm a writer. So we thought I could write the descriptions and Sarah could illustrate them. And this sort of percolated for, I guess, around, you know, for all these years. And finally, in the last couple of years, there's been just so much new interest in DMT, and so many of the internet's just overflowing with reports and entity contact experiences. So we thought that the time to do it was finally ripe.
Is the book out already? Is it like?
Oh yeah.
So like, I'm real curious on like what the feedback's been from like the psychonaut community, because when you're talking about these sort of things with your friends and stuff like that, it seems like there's always a ton of crossover. Have you noticed that in the feedback on the book as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've gotten more attention from this book than any of my previous books by far. It definitely hit a nerve. And there are, you know, just countless people sending me reports of their experiences. Yeah.
It's so personal for people. You know, and it really gives them an opportunity to open up the book and sort of look for the different archetypes that they've seen in their own visions. And I think that that's really compelling, and it really creates a conversation amongst other psychonauts too. So there's a lot of cross chatter, a lot of people talking about it with one another, and it's so accessible. Like, you could go to Barnes & Noble right now and pick it up in their self transformation section, which is really amazing. Just that it's become such a hot topic in the culture over the past 10 years. It's a lot more widely known than it was when David and I first came up with the idea.
Yeah, I think people want to talk about this too. When we started the podcast, people wanted to talk about their UFO experiences or their trip reports. Like, trip reports was actually a thing that we would read, like people's emails on their trip reports. And so it's it's good to have a place for and to be open where people can talk about their experiences now and not feel like they're just gonna get, you know, ridiculed by the skeptics or whatever. So what can you just overarching describe the book? Like, do you guys have, the top, I think what I read, the top 25 types of entities, that kind of thing?
Yeah. We chose 25 commonly reported entities, and I wrote the descriptions of them, and Sarah illustrated them. We also had about 100 other artists contribute to the book and share their illustrations as well. I gathered people's experiences from trip reports that I found online, and we chose the entities that we did from the scientific surveys that were done by Johns Hopkins University, Imperial College, the research they had done with extended state experiences. And we also tried to bring in reports from the UFO abduction phenomena as well. There was a lot of interesting crossover between those type of reports. And it's, like I said, it's put together in the form of a field guide, like the nature field guide that you use to identify different species in the wild.
Did you have any personal experiences that led to the book? Did you have any, like, was there like, you know, underlying experience with some sort of entities that have been, you know, either plaguing you? I mean,
we had plenty of experiences ourselves. You want to go first, Sarah, and describe some of your?
Sure. So I guess my fascination with DMT began probably around 2007. And I had initially come across it in Rick Strassman's book, you know, DMT, the Spirit Molecule, the classic. And I had some previous psychedelic experience, but it felt like all roads led to DMT. And I was super intrigued. So I did spend some time learning quite a bit about it, but I also didn't really want it to color my experience. There's so many archetypes covered in the Spirit Molecule alone that I felt like I was in a pretty good place to not necessarily be swayed by any one particular trip report or another. But gosh, my first experience was interesting because the beings that I encountered were very fractaline and checkered and rainbow and kaleidoscopic. And initially their attitude just seemed kind of like that of a jester or a harlequin or an acrobat, something like that. And they were creating glyphic letters with their bodies, kind of like an Indian goddess with, you know, 1,000 arms. And I found it funny at the time because I actually had kind of a fear of clowns growing up because of Stephen King's It. Someone put it on daytime television when I was like 5. Great idea. But it wasn't until I sat with the experience for a while that I realized that they were very much like jesters or clowns. And it kind of cured me of my fear of clowns. And I later went on to become a clown myself and go to clown school and incorporated into my performance art as a fire dancer and kind of like became a DMT ambassador in a way, just trying to find ways to express the ineffable in that experience. Because it felt like having gone through this amazing universal archive of creation and history, you know, all the way from, you know, the Big Bang through the, you know, development and evolution of the stars and the planets and then life on Earth and then human history, all the way down to this little microcosm that is, you know, my life and up to this DMT experience. But all of that happens like in the span of 5 minutes, you know, and you come back and I looked over to my dear friend David's face and he's got this sort of like iridescent, aurora colored, Maori spiraling pattern on his face. I've expressed that in art as well, but just the depth of the experience was so beyond what I felt like my imagination was capable of fabricating. And that was what initially made me just like endlessly fascinated with it, biochemically and culturally and just the modern psychonaut culture. And through my experiences over the years, I've encountered many, many different archetypes that sort of like evolve. And so it's not just these clown jesters, but I've also seen like goddesses riding golden bicycles and squids and crazy dark spaceships deep in the cosmos and all kinds of things. And just seeing the overlap between my own experiences and other people's was really intriguing. And so that was super fun to explore through the art of the book as well.
So I don't want to dive too deep into the pool right away here, but do you think these, like, I noticed you calling them archetypes. So I'm curious about that. And also, do you think another realm, and are these real entities compared to just your imagination? Like, is there any thoughts that either of you have about that? I mean, I'm kind of open to people's experiences. Sometimes it reminds me of the OBEs and the NDEs where they're like, this was real. That experience was realer than physical life to me. Like,
so for the sake of just like keeping the conversation open in general to people, I don't really like sit in a camp in any kind of definitive way. Right. I do think that the experience feels hyper real. It feels more real than real. The resolution of it, the immediacy of it. It's a very bizarre experience, especially when you've just lived your life in, you know, waking life and then dreams and lucid dreams, which I'm also a big fan of. But just grappling with that hyper reality subjective experience. And then also the fact that the things that I've seen, like I mentioned before, so wildly outside the scope of what I feel like my mind would be able to fabricate on its own. But I am really interested in like the brain imaging technology that people are going to be applying to it sometime soon, if not right now. And, you know, just kind of like broadening the definition of what we perceive reality to be. So I like to keep it in that kind of framework, and it makes it easier to relate to everybody's experience, but also honor other people's opinions.
I like that. It reminds me of certain dreams I've had where I'm like, how did my imagination even conjure up this crazy dream? Like, it feels out of the realm of possibility for me as a human to even do that. David, what about your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's something that I've wrestled with ever since I had my first DMT experience back in 1983, where a huge mantis being with my own face was doing some kind of brain surgery on me, and it did seem realer than real. You know, that phrase definitely comes to mind in terms of describing my own experience. I've wondered ever since that day whether there was an objective reality to these beings and to that realm, the hyperspace realm that people describe going to. And I don't know that there's really ever going to be an answer to that question. I mean, how do I know that you're really conscious right now? I mean, it's a leap of faith for me to assume that every other being is conscious, because there's no scientific measure of consciousness. It's all based upon assumptions that are based upon appearance and behavior and things like that. So it also may not be the right question to ask. You know, I think that it's possible that these beings, you know, are just in our minds, but that our minds may extend beyond our brains into other dimensions. So I've thought about this a lot. Every person that I interviewed for the book and in my other books, I've asked the question, what do you think? And I get, you know, a lot of different answers, but, you know, almost everybody agrees that the experience certainly seems incredibly real. And it's very hard to deny when you come out of it.
Darren, do you have any questions?
What we got a thing in the chat that someone says to stay away from the little monkey. Is this a popular character? And I mean, I've only had a couple, two DMT experiences. I did encounter an entity that I can't really remember, that said a word to me that I can't really remember, but I did just sort of get the feeling. I had kind of done it once and then did it again a few weeks later. And just the feeling that I got was, it was sort of just telling me to take a break or get out of here. Or I was into, I don't know. I honestly couldn't really ever remember it or put it together. But we do have someone talking about this monkey in the chats. I'm wondering if that's a character you've come across before.
Does that ring a bell for you, Sarah? You know, I don't know that we've had any monkeys. Somebody told me about a DMT experience they had where they were, where the beings were all monkeys with sunglasses, and I thought they were kind of parodying us. That's the way we looked to them, like monkeys with sunglasses, because they were so much more evolved than us. But that sounds like something personal. I mean, the monkey archetype is it's not something that I've seen a lot, but these beings transform, they change shape. And they mm-hmm. and they respond to our, you know, our cultural interpretations and expectations and things like that. So that could help to shape how people experience them.
So that's kind of one of the reasons why you call it an archetype, because maybe the monkey and there's other types, jesters, whatever, trickster type elements. Like some of them have that same let's say use trickster for example. Like you might see different types of entities, but they have that trickster element to them or something, even though they might be shape-shifting or.
That's definitely the approach that I tend to take to it. In the process of creating the art, I couldn't help but think that once we sort of strip a lot of the basic descriptors away, that a lot of these entities do have overlap, and especially with their shape and form, but also some of their demeanors and general vibe and attitude. And so I can't help but wonder if we're filtering it through some kind of linguistic lens. And, you know, there might be multiple, you know, genealogies of different being, but that human beings are like tagging it with these different linguistic descriptors. and that some of them can be, you know, culturally relevant to some groups and then, you know, totally different to another, but still having a little bit of that overlap.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is there trends through cultures and religions?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is. I mean, we have entries, for example, for different religious figures like Jesus and the Virgin Mary and Hindu deities and Egyptian deities and things like that, which are commonly reported. But you know, it's also really interesting that sometimes people report, deities or entities that they're not familiar with, yeah. You know, that they then look up in a book later and they say, mm-hmm. Oh my God, that's Kali, you know, from the Hindu tradition or things like that. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely many examples of people who encounter these deities or these archetypes that haven't had any prior experience with them. And then, you know, weeks later will be like, oh my God, that's who I saw on my DMT trip. You know, mm-hmm. so there is that, but certainly, and you know, it's one of the common remarks that people make is that, you know, Terence McKenna, for example, talking about the self-transforming machine elves influenced so many people, you know, having self-transforming machine elves experiences then after that, so that, you know, people's, you know, like dream priming, you know, it could be, could be affecting the way people interpret their experiences and their encounters with these entities.
Yeah, that's a good point. Have these, because I know Darren, if we look back at Darren's experience, which is quite a few years ago now, I bet you we see a change in his life, a different trajectory, maybe like finding his path kind of thing. Like I bet you, I know we've sort of talked about it a little bit, Darren, but we haven't really dug into the details and looked back at the actual dates. But are these, do people have transformational experiences with entities more than they would on a normal trip? Or do you guys catalog some of their transformational experiences as well? Or is there any kind of like epiphanies or advice that they get from entities?
Yeah, some of the most common advice that I hear from people is, you know, is take care of the planet and you know, be aware of what climate change is doing and the threat of nuclear war and kind of grand messages like that. But I think that the therapeutic aspects of DMT are seen more with ayahuasca, you know, which is the shamanic brew from the Amazon, where the, you know, DMT containing plants are mixed with harmaline, you know, containing plants, an MAO inhibitor that makes it not only orally active, but slows down the experience and you know, make and extends it, you know, for hours, so that it's not a 5-minute rush into hyperspace where people confront these entities and come back, and where they can digest the experience more slowly. And many people describe, you know, therapeutic and healing potential with the ayahuasca mix. But you know, they're doing studies now at Imperial College in London and elsewhere, where they're putting people out on full doses of DMT, just DMT, not ayahuasca, and they're putting them into extended state, you know, sessions where people, where that 5 minutes is extended into 30 minutes or an hour or even longer, so people can spend hours into there. So the idea is that people will be able to bring back more information from their communication with these entities.
What was the art and the, like, the feedback loop like on designing the entities and sort of bringing them to life? You've got all these sort of different, what was the process like? Did you just sort of do it all yourself, or was there sort of a back and forth with other DMT experiencers, or how did you handle that, developing the entities?
It was very extensive. So a lot of the challenge comes between how do you find a balance between something that's recognizable and something that's still psychedelic? Because the more abstract and psychedelic we get, the harder it is for everybody to come to a consensus that it looks archetypal. You know, like you recognize that it's a fairy or a mantis or a clown or a machine elf, those things. So a lot of it was initially research-based and just focusing on how do I develop vocabulary that the limited language model can understand, because in a way a lot of the art is curated with AI image generation as a way to have a conversation with the collective consciousness. And so a lot of it is careful curation, as well as, you know, in a way I feel like it was really novel. Not many people had been creating images at that point with the kind of language that the limited language model was even familiar with at that point. So finding, you know, like, do I describe it as just hyperdimensional? What does it think I mean when I say hyperdimensional? What does it think I mean when I say ethereal or futuristic or cosmic? And so having a really broad familiarity with people's trip reports over the past 10 years, because, you know, much like David, I find myself really fascinated with people's reports and just sort of incorporating that from a linguistic level, but also just like refining it. I went through probably about 3,000 or more iterations of art, and there's a lot of recursive feedback loops that were created as well. So it's not just like prompt in, image out. A lot of it is exploring the space and kind of like exploring this collective mindscape, you know, of all of these different visions that are directly informed by human culture and storytelling, movies and culture and articles and art. So that was actually like a really fun part of the process, but initially it felt kind of daunting because you're just suddenly plunked into this, you know, blue ocean of imagery. And finding the intuitive curator in all of that, just being able to look at all these dozens of images in a single session of workflow and be like, okay, that one really speaks to me, you know, or that one has that magic quality that I think other people will resonate with too, for the different archetypes. And then going from there, and just, there was a lot of compositing involved. You know, it's not just the image generation, but there was tons of compositing. There was a lot of overpainting. There was a lot of reiterative blending between images. And so each one really took a lot of time and a lot of patience to fine tune in a way that felt like it was the right image for the entries. And some of the entries have multiple images. There's also a lot of original art from earlier parts of my career in traditional mediums. I've been drawing and painting DMT entities for the better part of the past 20 years.
Have you had any feedback from people that are like, wow, that really resonates with me and my experience at all?
Oh, yeah. Gosh, my personal favorite is my very first DMT entity drawing, and it comes from my very first trip. And it is unique in that it doesn't necessarily read as any one thing. I feel like it was probably a more raw data barometer. It was from a trip, my very first trip back in like 2007, maybe 2008. And it was that kaleidoscopic rainbow pixelated guy who's doing the little dance moves, right? And I drew a pencil drawing when I came back from the trip, and I managed to really capture something there, and I was able to show it to some close friends of mine. But as I developed it and then later eventually painted it digitally, when I would show it to people, it knocked a lot of socks off. People were like, holy shit, that is what I saw. And it felt really good to be able to have this kind of consensus reality, almost like a postcard from hyperspace. And so that's probably one of my favorite images that we were able to include in the book.
Yeah, that's great. And also just to get that feedback, because then it makes me think, well, maybe it really is a real realm that you went to. If everybody's resonating and seeing the same thing, that's one of the things that you can point to that everybody goes, yes, that is it. You know, like they've, because it's hard to just describe all this stuff.
Very.
Off your head, you know? Yeah. What about the favorite types of entities? Or actually, let me ask this one, because I definitely want to get to this at some point. Is there any scary ones that you would warn people away from, or that people have had like negative, like an archetype or a type that people see that they've had negative experiences with, or something to stay away from?
Yeah, well, we have a whole section on demons and demonic entities, you know, so there are certainly, you know, terrifying you know, entities that people encounter. It's interesting, though, that you know, some people report how sometimes the entity will transform from a demon to an angel, you know, during the experience, like there's some kind of transformation. But also the mantis entities, the praying mantis, large praying mantis entities, are commonly reported as being pretty scary and intimidating. My own experience with the mantis entity when it was operating or fine tuning or adjusting something in my brain, it was a fairly terrifying experience. I wouldn't say it was very pleasant. I was not in control of what was happening. I felt like I was being pinned down. Graham Hancock describes a a terrifying encounter that he had with some type of robotic entity in the book. So there are definitely, you know, they're usually not always pleasant experiences. I mean, they run the whole full spectrum of being pleasant to terrifying.
Mm. What about, I remember talking to some people at an ayahuasca ceremony, and they've had these experiences where they would see like entities come out of people. I think black shadowy shapes kind of coming out of people. And was it coming out or going in? I feel like it was a healing, like they were describing sort of a healing where one of these entities was pulled out of a person. Is there examples like that in there too?
Yeah, well, the ayahuasca experiences, although they involve DMT, they're different than the pure DMT projections into hyperspace that we'll be describing, you know, that really is the foundation for our book. When you smoke pure DMT or vaporize pure DMT, when you do what Terence McKenna would call three large hits of it, you're completely separated from this world, and you are in, you know, hyperspace. You're in a whole nother dimension. You look around and you are really there. When you do ayahuasca, it's like you have one foot in this world and one foot in that world. You're kind of straddling the two worlds. So people report how the entities affect people in this world. I've certainly heard many reports like you're describing, you know, about ayahuasca in general. But that's not something that we really cover in the book, because we're really focusing on the entity contact that happens in hyperspace.
So what about some of the parallels between, you know, fairies going back hundreds of years, like medieval type fairies, modern day abductions, the grays, like people seem to see the same entities.
That's one of the things we really tried to incorporate in the book, is the UFO alien abduct UFO contactee alien abduction reports. The mantis entities that I described are also in the alien abduction report.
Yeah.
The gray entities, reptilians are another example. And then of course there are the fairy sightings, you know, from Ireland and from Great Britain, where people describe being kidnapped and taken to a timeless realm. And there's incredible parallels between that and the alien abduction phenomena and the DMT entity experience.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Yeah, as well as the kobolds too, which are like little Germanic kind of gnome-like creatures that are associated with the earth and mining and things like that. Whitley Strieber's experience with his, you know, alien abduction, he directly references the kobolds, you know, that these little short grayish-blue guys. And so I found that really interesting while David was doing the research for the book, as well as, you know, me creating different images for that category in particular, that's been a longstanding, you know, sort of non-human entity contact experience going back into folklore, aside, you know, the more commonly known ones like fairies and things like that. But yeah, that they reach all the way into more like postmodern UFO abductions.
Is there a direct, like, would just in a personal, your personal opinion, after doing all this research and putting it all in the book, is there a direct, do you think there's a direct link there? Like, is it the same? Are we talking about the same thing, or is it more of a coincidence or a consciousness thing?
Oh, I think that there's definitely something to it. That was partly why we thought that there, you know, there's evidence for an objective reality to this, that it, you can see it from these different types of experiences. I mean, there have been many people who have tried to draw parallels between the fairy kidnapping and the fairy sightings with the alien abduction phenomena. And we just, you know, we added the DMT element to it, but it's kind of a long, you know, Graham Hancock in his book Visionary explores this in great depth for hundreds of pages, the similarities between the three different phenomena.
Especially with people talking about the pineal gland and DMT, endogenous DMT, I guess they're sort of trying to make a parallel that maybe it's not like physical aliens, but something's manipulating your own DMT and creating that parallel.
I spoke to the late psychiatric researcher, John Mack, the author of Abduction, specifically about that. And he thought that it was, he agreed with you that it was definitely possible that because there's, you know, the people could be on their own, you know, endogenous DMT levels could be going up because people report altered states of consciousness prior to the abduction. They hear like a loud buzzing sound, or they, you know, they feel like they're leaving their body. So there's contradictory, you know, evidence in this area. Some people, you know, see their partners completely, you know, not present in their bed at the time. Other times people report that their partner is there, you know, when they have these abduction experiences, for example. So it seems like it's not really clear, but the altered state of consciousness does seem to be a consistent factor in people's reports.
Yeah. What about ancient examples, ancient wisdom, like acacia, DMT from the acacia plant? Have you guys discovered or researched any of the sort of potential encounters going way, way back into ancient times?
No, I can't really think of it. I mean, we have some examples of cave art, for example, in the book, where from I think like, you know, 40,000 years ago with what, you know, look like you know, animal human hybrid entities, for example, or beings that looked like the gray entities with the large, you know, black almond shaped mm-hmm. eyes. So there's certainly cave painting evidence for these beings going back thousands of years.
And there was some contemporary art shared with us for the book as well that had a lot of aesthetic similarities. And so I definitely think that there's a kind of, you know, running thread throughout human expression that has a lot of similarities to the more ancient cave art when encountering what looked like, you know, representations of whether it's paranormal or ecstatic states or just, you know, altered consciousness in general.
Yeah.
In fact, there's actually an example in the book of the cave art, one side and a modern piece on the other, where it looks like there's an uncanny resemblance between the two different entities that are being portrayed.
Which ones are the most popular then? I mean, you mentioned the little miner dudes. They kind of make me think of the Machine Elves right away. You know, it also makes me think of the Smurfs. You know, you never know how many of these like. Mm-hmm. Cartoonist guys were tripping out back in the day, but the big ones that come to mind are the Machine Elves, I think, and the little dudes in the cloaks. I mean, when I got my wisdom teeth out, I remember some little dudes in some cloaks. They were just like, I could never see the faces, and they were just, I was just a kid too. I want to say I was like 12 or 13, and I don't know what they put me on, but I was like tripping out when I was, remember, like I was coming to and I was like fucking with the person besides me's IV. But I remember like these dudes in these little brown cloaks, you can maybe see their nose, but not their face. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You kind of mix it with the pop culture a little bit too. But I definitely remember it was like just a bunch of little short dudes in brown cloaks wandering around while I was under the influence of anesthetic.
Yeah,
that's wild.
But you didn't know many better at the time?
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, one of the most common is what Sarah described on her first experience is clowns and jesters. I hear that's probably more than almost anything else, and maybe the elves, the self transforming machine elves, are sort of second place.
What else is in there? What are sort of the weird ones that are less encountered that might trip people out?
Well, all the 25 that we chose for the book are all pretty common. You know, the octopus beings are pretty common. Kara had an experience with one of those.
The octopus being?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Want to talk about
those are quite popular, actually, and they're sort of yeah, I feel like that would totally be related and an adjacent representation for sure. Sometimes people say they're like squids, sometimes, you know, just some kind of multi-tentacled entity. And a lot of times people will describe them as sort of indifferent or even potentially a little bit on the darker side. My personal experience was with, if I remember right, it was a Chaga experience I had, or Changa, pardon me, saying that wrong. I found myself in a dark spaceship with a large squid-like being that was just sort of silently observing me. And we didn't really have any kind of open communication, but I was just sort of taking in the scene visually with as much detail as I could. but it was definitely out in space, and it was a very technological kind of vessel that it was in, and it was definitely a multi-tentacled kind of creature. It was very bizarre.
Do you remember what the face, like, was it a tentacled as in the limbs, or was there a face sort of part of that?
It was like its whole body and head. It wasn't like a anthropomorphized being. It was definitely like a big squid, octopus, alien guy in a spaceship. I definitely remember its eye, but overall it was sort of just like seeing glimmering highlights in a very dark space. And it was fairly desaturated of color, oddly enough, which I didn't expect, because since so many experiences are pretty bright and colorful. But with Changa, I find that a lot of my personal visuals tend to be on the more like dim side. I don't want to say dark, because I don't mean any kind of connotation to that in an energetic way. It's just like it's a not as brightly lit place. But it often feels like being in a deep sea coral reef, like at night or something, where you're only seeing little glints and images, you know, just highlights and edges and stuff like that, that are sort of phosphorescent looking.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to clarify for your listeners who may not know, Sarah's talking about Changa, which is actually a mix between two different plants. It has a Syrian Roe and a Mimosa hostilis, which has DMT in it. One contains an MAO inhibitor. So it's kind of like a smokable ayahuasca is what it's like. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Is there any other psychedelics that are in the book as far as examples too?
Oh yeah, we cover the whole gamut. There, you know, it's not as extensive, but we have examples of people from their psilocybin, you know, magic mushroom experiences, from their peyote experiences, from ketamine, salvia divinorum. You know, I mean, almost all the psychedelics.
Oh, okay.
Which for some people, there's some kind of entity contact phenomena, but it's much rarer than it is with the with pure DMT. But people talk about, you know, ayahuasca having a spirit to it. People talk about the mushrooms having a kind of spirit or entity that, you know, that talks to them or communicates with them. And so it's not an uncommon experience with other psychedelics.
I have a fun little anecdote sort of to add to that briefly. I remember really early on in my DMT use, I had gone back to a mushroom trip, and in particular, you know, I hadn't had super direct mushroom entity contact, but I remember sort of being telepathically told, like, oh, you met our cousins during that mushroom trip. And I was like, what do you mean? And they're like, DMT. And I was like, oh, really? And they're like, yes, that is our cousin. You know, we're sort of like the more terrestrial, sort of like Earth ambassador of that same energy. But if you're talking to DMT, like, feel free to dive into that. And I found that kind of like funny and charming at the time, because mushrooms were my first psychedelic plant teacher, fungal teacher, you know, and I had a lot of extensive work with that. But it was almost like, you know, homey and familial and really wholesome to kind of get that message from the mushroom after having encountered DMT.
Yeah, yeah. So Mother Ayahuasca is the cousin. I like that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's extremely common with ayahuasca. I mean, there is almost everybody who does ayahuasca describes either Mother Ayahuasca or Grandmother Ayahuasca. Mm-hmm. This wise teaching entity that shows them and heals them in different ways. But I mean, I personally had the experience. I had a number of experiences with what's called what they call pharmawasca, which Sarah and I had experiences with that together, where we did Syrian root tea and then smoked pure DMT. And I kind of thought that was an ayahuasca experience until I went down to the Peruvian Amazon and did ayahuasca from the traditional plants down there. Mm-hmm. And the experience of contact with this mother ayahuasca was profoundly different and profoundly present when I had that experience. So it's something that's almost undeniable. It's so common.
Do most of these manifest as a dragon archetype, or do they mother ayahuasca as a dragon, or
I haven't heard. I mean, I have heard. I've heard that. I don't know that it's mostly that way. It's usually a voice.
Okay.
You know, but people mm-hmm. see jaguars and serpents. You know, commonly with ayahuasca or different different Amazonian jungle animals. There've been strange reports of people doing ayahuasca. You know, outside of the Amazon. In city settings and still seeing, you know, the jaguars and the snakes and, you know, different animals.
One of my dear friends had probably my favorite trip report I'd ever heard was a dear friend of mine, and her first time smoking DMT, she described seeing a jaguar, dragon, serpent, goddess, and that it was just like this multi-fusion entity. And I think that was why it was such a favorite. It felt like she had sort of broken beyond all these different cultural filters and was experiencing all of them at once.
I love that. So what about messages to humanity, not just messages, but technologically, like, is there sort of some blueprint type stuff, downloads, technological type stuff that's being passed along as well?
Yeah, we're hoping that with these extended state studies that people are going to come back with blueprints for starships and time machines and matter transporters. I don't know if anybody that's come back with anything like that, but the common messages that we hear are just that, you know, humanity is in danger, you know, that, you know, the climate crisis and the nuclear Holocaust crisis and things like that, and that we need to care for our planet. Those are some of the more common messages that people come back to. But remember, people only generally have 5 or 10 minutes there with these entities. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of time to bring back the starship blueprints yet.
Mm-hmm. When do you think we'll see that kind of stuff happening? Like, are they doing it right now? Like,
they're doing their studies right now. Yeah, the studies are going on at Imperial College. Yep. And in fact, what they're doing at the moment is they're sending people out together. You know, they're sending people out at the same time to see if they can actually link up in hyperspace.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Go on like a team mission, you know, mm-hmm. together and hopefully they're going to come back with longer and more detailed messages about what the entities communicate.
It's not mm-hmm. all like slow released intravenous type stuff, like delivery method.
Yeah, exactly. The way you get an anesthetic when you're under surgery, where you're sort of where you get a slow infusion that just can keep you in that state for an indefinite period of time. There's no tolerance that's built up to DMT, so it you can keep the same. It's very easy to adjust the levels, and people can stay in the state indefinitely.
Matt, is there any repercussions to an extended length of time in a DMT state? I mean, I don't know that I can handle any longer.
Yeah, I haven't heard of any yet. I mean, I've interviewed a few of the subjects who have been in some of the trials, but I haven't heard of any long-term effects aside from their level of astonishment and just reflecting on these experiences. Mm-hmm. But you know, we certainly know from people's ayahuasca experience that mostly people report healing and transcendent experiences that help them in the future.
Wow. I wonder, if was there any difference in those sort of, like, are there any of the interviews in the book? Is there a difference between, is there still a recollection problem, or is there more recollection?
Oh, and people usually don't have a recollection problem. That's not real common it's common with other psychedelics, for example, like ketamine, or MXE or salvia divinorum. Sometimes people have more of a difficulty bringing those experiences back, but people usually remember their DMT experiences with crystal clarity. You know, there's not a feeling of being drugged, really.
Add a caveat, though, that I've definitely heard a number of people struggle with recollection. I wouldn't say that it's a universal, but it might just be like a smaller percentage of the population that struggles with the recollection. And honestly, the advice that I've given folks is it seems to really mimic the way some folks have a challenging time remembering their dreams. And so it helps to work backwards from where you are, rather than to try to remember the beginning of the trip and work forward to the present moment, is if you just start where you are and work backwards, like this last moment, the moment before that, the moment before that, it's going to be easier to follow that breadcrumb trail back and to be able to like assimilate those memories from one state of consciousness to another. Like I said, it's not universal, but I've definitely encountered some folks who struggle with the recollection bit, but it's sort of like muscle memory. The more you practice that with your dream life, I think it helps with psychedelic, recollection as well. And I've also seen people utilize that to better remember their memories from other more challenging catalysts, like, for example, ketamine.
What about writing it down, too, right afterwards?
Part of the recollection problem could be just that there's such an incredible rush. There's such an abundance of information that you experience. I mean, you experience more in 5 minutes than you usually do in a year. I mean, it's just an incredible amount of information. So sometimes it's difficult remembering it all.
But, I personally find writing can be a little harder just if you're trying to capture that spark immediately after coming back, because, you know, writing utensils are still a little cumbersome. But one of the things that I found really useful personally was just, because I can speak before I can write coming out of those experiences.
I agree 100%.
Right. And, you know, I had a pretty phenomenal pharmawaska experience years ago with David, and I just recorded the whole thing and spoke to myself throughout the trip and cataloged it that way and then transcribed it after the fact. And that was easily, you know, one of the more incredible experiences that I had in general, let alone being able to transcribe it in a lot of clarity.
That's a great idea. I wish I could do that with dreams, record the dreams throughout.
We're getting there. We'll get to the dream recording software soon. Honestly, that reminds me of the other research that Zeus Dupato is doing in the Netherlands, which is really significant. He's looking to do brain imaging of people who are, you know, tripping out on the DMT, and then with hopes of being able to reconstruct that in VR later on.
Wow. Yeah. I was going to ask you about the VR and how that, if that's changed your view of these realms at all, having to map out these in real time.
Obviously, like if anybody looks into my little artistic history, I'm a big VR nerd and a big VR fan. I'm definitely interested in sort of using brain imaging as a cartography for VR. I don't think we're quite there yet. Okay. But I do think that VR is really useful for sort of capturing the subjectivity of a psychedelic experience and being able to sort of like share that with someone. Uh-huh. So you can pop them into your piece of VR art and be like, this is what it was like, you know, and have it be a whole, you know, world that they can interact with and inhabit. Right now, it's a little bit more like a living painting rather than something that is directly modeled after the data. But I'm absolutely in love with lots of really amazing psychedelic VR apps, like Trip VR is super cool. And, you know, that's created as sort of like a meditative therapeutic application for psychedelic inspired virtual reality art. A lot of brave people have been combining the two. I am a personal fan of that. I mean, some catalysts work better than others. But that could be a really amazing experience because it's almost like the psychedelic sort of infuses itself into this new medium. Because for me, like VR is a reflection of our imagination and our mind. I don't really think of it as a simulation or a fake world or something unreal. I think of it as like a living reflection of the imagination. And so I'm really excited where it'll go in the next few years with, you know, more development and more access to everyday folks and just creating that kind of familiarity with it, as well as the dovetailing of that with psychedelic culture in general.
Yeah, that'll be fascinating. Even tools that can enable you to create your own experience in there, maybe.
Do you ever worry that'll like you know, because I was like a staunch, I was not gonna watch the Game of Thrones because I read the books, and you know, I had read the books several times and built this whole world in my head, you know, this whole Westeros that was sort of different from everyone else's, all the characters were sort of different. And I watched it, and you know, and I had read it so many fucking times that I was like, you know, there's no way I can watch. I should be able to watch it. And you know, I watched it, and I can't. The world that I built is fucking gone. You know, it's just completely obliterated by Hollywood. And I don't know if that's because I just, maybe if I would have read the more books, but you know, I read the book say 4 times compared to watching the series once, and the series and the books are 10 times longer. So you're immersed in it for longer, mm-hmm. but it managed to just like almost beat it out. Like I couldn't even like really pull up, you know, I can get little fleeting images of some of where the some of the characters used to be, but for the most part, they're all the ones that were on the TV now.
Wow.
The same ones that everybody else has. And it's given me some firm lines on now watching shows or movies to books that I've read. But do you ever concern that this VR world designed by other people could start to almost homogenize the experiences a little bit? Like it's always because we're like victims of our own memory in a certain way. You know what I mean? It's not as good as we think it is, and it can get convoluted, and it just sort of, I wonder if that same sort of movie ruining the book analogy can transfer over to these other mediums.
That's a really good question. So from my own personal experience, I'm going to use 2 sci-fi things just to dovetail off of the Game of Thrones thing. I heard the end credits to Blade Runner when I was 15, and I hadn't seen the movie. And Vangelis's music was so good that I was like, I want to know this story, but I want to read the book first. So I did. And it's wildly different, but it has the same soul. And when I watched Blade Runner, I wasn't disappointed, but I was, you know, just really impressed with the ability to like world build in a way that felt akin to the world that I experienced when I read the book. Another funny example might be Dune, because I watched the David Lynch Dune around the same age, and I was so impressed by it that I couldn't get enough. I was like, that was amazing. I need to read the book right now. And it's so much more in depth than, you know, his super long film could even tap into. But funny enough, later on, when Denis Villeneuve created the more recent Dune, I felt like that Dune was much more like the Dune I experienced in my imagination. And so I think that it's like a really malleable thing. Like people are going to have different visions of different works. And there's even sci-fi nerds who, you know, say that Frank Herbert was inspired by, you know, Asimov, or that George Lucas was inspired by Frank Herbert. When it comes to the psychedelic space, I feel like in VR, they're all snapshots of people's personal experiences. And there's going to be a little bit of a risk of like dream seeding, as David called it earlier. But there's just such an amazing quality where like even people who've kept themselves sort of isolated from reading trip reports and looking at other people's stuff, like they still encounter similar places. I remember being a visionary artist in the San Francisco Bay Area 15 years ago, and I kept seeing this art that had these similarities. And I was like, what is going on with this visionary genre that looks unlike acid, unlike mushrooms, unlike DMT, but they all have these hallmarks. And it turns out it was ketamine. All of these artists were cartographers of the deep ketamine space. And it wasn't until I had experienced it on my own that I said, wait a minute, I have seen this before. And it wasn't self-seeding, because I mean, I've seen probably like hundreds of thousands of visionary art pieces over the past 25, 30 years, right? But the fact that I was able to recognize that aesthetic and know exactly culturally where it came from, because that was the flavor of that era in that place culturally.
That's fascinating.
So I don't worry about it too much. It's definitely something to keep in mind, but I think that, you know, we all stand on the shoulders of giants when it comes to the imagination. Our imagination is like a patchwork quilt that has overlapping edges with one another rather than being like isolated islands.
Darren, does that Dune ring a bell with you at all? Or
I don't know.
What was your experience?
I wasn't crazy about the first Dune. I mean, the second Dune was all right. They did a much better job of mimicking coming closer to the world that you sort of built in your head. I would definitely agree with that. That being said, I don't know that I'll dip any deeper into it, because Messiah is one of my favorite books in the series. And then like the Children of Dune after that, those are kind of, I mean, I, you end up liking the one where he's a giant sandworm more than you.
Yes, I love God Emperor. You speak my language. Like, the Golden Path.
When I was reading it, I was like, "This is fucking nuts. What is going on? What have they have done?" Because it's such a far jump from the book three. But then when you're done the series, it just sort of resonates. I mean, it really does. It gets weird with the unlimited Duncan Idahos and all that. But I'm probably just going to be happy with the first two Dunes, and I don't think that I'll risk going any deeper into it, because I do like, I'm definitely a lot more, because when I look at those first, especially the original six Dune books, I mean, in a lot of ways, the first one is not even in the top three. It really isn't. So there was a lot less risk to those ones than there is to the later works, which I think, you know, they definitely start to delve farther and farther away from the Star Trek, and it really finds its own world by book three. Yeah.
Sort of to get off topic a little bit, but Sarah, where do you find the VR space right now compared to AR and MR, when where that's going? Like, is it going to be sustainable or?
Apple Vision Pro and its ecosystem have proven to be kind of disappointing in the past year. I don't think VR is going to die. I think that even with Meta potentially moving away from that it's just going to open up space to other developers. Like, we've gotten a taste of it, you know, and just like to create this kind of flow between these ideas. There's a lot of overlap with the spice in Dune having, you know, been used culturally as a metaphor for DMT. And in a way, I find that, you know, VR is kind of that thing that allows us to transcend our normal perceptions, you know, kind of like Paul seeing past the valleys of time. I think that VR is this amazing tool that, you know, gives us the ability to see outside of normal consciousness without necessarily having to take a drug. And I think that being able to yoke that in the future, as we encounter all kinds of new technologies that like stretch the data that we can incorporate and understand, you know, there's a really amazing academic thinker who is involved in the DMTX study. His name is Carl Hayden Smith, and he does a lot of work, you know, with cyberdelics in particular. And so I definitely see VR as a really powerful potential cyberdelic in the near future. And I don't think anybody's going to shut that Pandora's box once they've had a taste of it.
What's that? Can I just pick away at that a little bit? What's it going to look like? So you're talking about this being like, so go into VR with the psychedelics. So now that sort of gives you a whole other base platform to experience psychedelics in. Like, so you've got none of these other normal distractions, you know, the light and the sounds and the feel, like now you're in it already kind of thing. And
well, even beyond, you know, using psychedelics in tandem with VR, I think that in the next few years, we're going to see a lot of VR technologies that incorporate real-time brain imaging, kind of like we were talking about thinking about the psychedelics, but just, you know, with VR natively, being able to create gaming scenarios where, you know, machine learning can be reading your mind, you know, and yes, there's terrible privacy concerns regarding that. But that part aside, you know, being able to explore worlds and gaming experiences that unfold with your mind in real time. You know, so rather than it being like a fixed sandbox that a developer created with the game, having it be like an open-ended story that you engage with from moment to moment. Yeah.
Wow. Like an RPG in VR, kind of like a real RPG. Yeah. Wow.
Like that old trippy movie. Remember where they put the worms in their back, that Existenz or whatever?
Existenz, totally.
That shit was a trip back in the day, man. I didn't even know what the fuck was going on. I was just a kid too, watching it on TV. I was like, what is happening? But I mean, now it's one of those better movies. This has been great, guys. Where's the best place for people to get the book? Where can they, or do you guys have any social media they can follow you on, anything like that?
The book's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Pretty much every bookseller has it. It was published by Inner Traditions. That's probably, we would consider the best place to get it, but wherever it really is most convenient. Sarah even found it in the local Barnes & Noble bookstore. You can find me on social media, on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram. It's easy to find me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll put links in there. What about you, Sarah?
I'm also on Instagram and Twitter, not so much Facebook these days, but you can find me at dreamseed_VR.
Okay.
And that I also have a little YouTube channel where I get into the nerdy sci-fi stuff. I think you dig, Darren. We have a lot of similar tastes. Cool. But yeah, that's probably the best way to find the VR art as well as all these DMT entities.
Awesome.
Is there like any new projects coming up people should be submitting for or anything like that? Are you looking for any feedback or like stories or anything like that? Do you have any new books on the horizon?
Not that I know of in particular, but we did just recently get the green light from Inner Traditions that we're going to be creating a companion oracle deck for the DMT entity book.
Oh my God. I was going to ask that and I thought that's just a dumb question. I was going to be like, you guys should make an oracle deck out of all
that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, we got you.
Awesome. Well, that's good. I'm looking forward to seeing that. That'll be great.
Yeah. We actually just got a contract for that. So Sarah is going to be designing the artwork for the oracle cards, and me and Rachel Turetsky are doing the instruction booklet that goes with it.
That's fantastic. Right on.
Great. Congratulations. I'll have to tell Manzanita to send me a set.
Yeah. We'll have to get some for the studio. Yeah.
Congratulations, guys. Thanks for coming on the show. This has been great. And when the cards come out, let us know and we'll do it again.
We'll do. Cool. Thank you so much, thanks. Gentlemen.
All right. Ciao.
Thank you.
Bye.
And that was our chat with Sarah and David from the Illustrated Field Guide to DMT Entities. What'd you think?
Oh, yeah, that was good. Yeah, that was fun. Yeah.
Any closer to doing some DMT?
No, I'm coming up on my 17-year anniversary in less than a week here. So, no, I don't think so. No.
Man, you weren't even at a decade yet when we met.
I know. Isn't that weird? Yeah.
And you didn't fall off the wagon at my bachelor party or nothing. So,
no, I know. Mm.
Big thanks to David and Sarah for coming to the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. Check out the stuff, of course, and head over to grimerica.ca/support today and sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation if you are getting some value from the show. We do count on you guys. We don't have any other, no one else pays for this show except for you guys if you choose to. As long as you choose to, we will keep doing it. So if you can head over to grimerica.ca/support today and sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation if you are getting some value from the show, send some value back our way. And the more support we get, the more shows we'll do. I mean, it just boils down to that. Of course, you can check out our other show that we do, more controversial stuff, a lot more political and conspiracy. Mind it over there at grimericaoutlawed.ca or grimericaoutlawed, wherever you listen to podcasts. Contact at the cabin for trips and events. We got a few spots left for this trip coming up with Randall Carlson in a couple months in Bonneville. We just started the Telegram group today, so it's getting real. We got to tell you, get a private Zoom meeting with the group and Randall Carlson answering all your questions. Before he answers all your questions for a week later, straight, he'll answer your questions in the Zoom. So that's contact@thecabin.com and, of course, adultbrain.ca for all sorts of audiobooks. We also got some print books and some ebooks for sale. You can publish your book through us if you want some help with that. We'll make an audiobook for you, everything you need. And like I say, tons of audiobooks. We just had a bunch come out on Audible. There's even more on Spotify. They're all there, adultbrain.ca. And there's links to get to the places you can buy them as well from there. So. And GrimericaCBD.com for tinctures and gummies, if that's your thing. Check it out, GrimericaCBD.com. And there might be some psychedelic people on this episode, so check out GrimErica.ca/rooms if you're looking to partake in something like that. I mean, one guy said he didn't like it, but everyone else said they did like it. So I'm going back to promoting it. So, sorry, Rohan. But then now we love you guys. Thanks for listening. And we will see you next week.
Somehow I built a rocket ship out of the stuff dreams are made and popsicle sticks. Please look at my rocket ship schematics. Tell me it can fly to the moon. Tell me I'm not a lunatic. I bet you think I'm the smartest. space cadet. I bet, I bet, I bet you think, I bet you think I'm a space cadet. No regret, I do not fret, 'cause I am a space cadet. In my hands I have a gas can and matchsticks. Yes, Earth is my home, but I need a vacation from all the sadness, the chaos and dramatics. I'll let you do the countdown, 3, 2, 1, no hesitation. Thank you.